Hey, Dan.
Hi, Jason.
I was going to say we haven't been in the same place in a little while, but that's not what I mean.
I mean, we haven't been in the same place for a long while.
Yeah, it's been since WWDC, but we haven't been like on the clock working simultaneously for a couple of weeks, I think.
Well, it's summer, vacation time, travel
time. Yeah, that's
it.
That's exactly it. I went away for a week and then for a weekend, and then you went away for a week, and then I went away again. It's just, it's summer.
I got to go, by the way. No.
All right.
I briefly had a moment yesterday of watching people tweet about being at Worldcon this year, which we both attended last year.
Right.
Thought, I probably could just go get on a plane tomorrow and go. No, that's ridiculous.
Let's go to Kansas City. Kansas City, here I come.
I did think about it, though. I did think about it.
Yeah.
But here I am, back at the grind, back at my desk.
Yeah. Yeah, me too. Me too. I got back yesterday from a couple of days in Memphis with the Relay Boys.
Those guys.
I know. It was nice. I had some barbecue.
That's what you do in Memphis?
I had some beer.
Standing. Also a good choice.
We had a meetup.
How was that?
Nice.
Was that good?
It was really good. Great turnout. Like 20 or 30 people came out to see us in Memphis. And it wasn't all like Steven's family. It was it was a whole group of people. I met some very nice people, some members who listen to the podcast. So hello to you. You know who you are. And one gentleman was wearing an Incomparable t-shirt. So I appreciated that. Actually, two gentlemen were wearing Incomparable t-shirts. But one of those gentlemen was Mike Hurley. But there was also an attendee who was wearing an Incomparable t-shirt. So that was cool.
Mike doesn't count.
Okay. No, he totally doesn't count. Although we did have to coordinate shirts because, Mike and Steven and I all have lots of podcast t-shirts. So we had to, which one are you wearing? In fact, when Mike got off the plane, so I got off the plane like a couple hours before Mike got off his plane in Memphis. And it was funny. We both wore the same t-shirt. So it's a problem when you are around other people. In fact, Steven told me a story about how he found a t-shirt he really loved on I want to say Cotton Bureau. Mm-hmm. And he thought it was amazing. And it was like two short of being printed, three short of being printed, something like that. And so what he did was he bought three of them and didn't tell anybody it existed because he didn't want everybody else to have his same shirt. And so he was wearing it. And I'm like, wow, that's a really great shirt. And he's like, yeah, nobody has it.
But 28 or something other people have it. Yeah.
That is diabolical that you would do it like that. But I well played. Well played.
Yes, the only person I saw at Gen Con wearing an Incomparable shirt besides me was David Lohr.
Yeah.
So, also.
That's okay.
Doesn't really count, but that's okay.
Oh, actually, this is funny. It looks like they reprinted that shirt of Steven, so I should buy one.
Oh, wait, I want one too.
I should buy one right now and then wear it when I'm around him just to surprise him and anger him. Oh, he's probably listening to this, though, so that's less good. Hi, Steven. Nerd t-shirts, it's a problem. It's a serious problem. What's going on, Dan? I on Clockwise today, Dan Frakes mentioned I'm sure, did you talk about this story about this survey? I'm like, I don't know what you're talking about.
What is news?
I am focusing so much of my time on writing about photos for Sierra, and because my book is being revised and sort of thinking about writing about Sierra and maybe about iOS 10, although the more I know about how many words Federico Vittici has written about iOS 10, the less I want to write anything about iOS 10. So that's what I've been focusing on.
We discussed not being in that game before.
Yeah.
That's a hard game.
I never wanted to write 40,000 words of a review of anything. I don't, that's not what I want to do. That's just not the game I want to play. And he took his whole summer writing an iOS 10 review, and it's going to be great. But that's not the game I want to play. But it does sort of lessen my enthusiasm in some ways from even like writing 5,000 words about it. And it makes me think maybe I should focus. What it's done is really made me think, okay, a lot of people out there are going to give a lot of love to iOS 10. Maybe I should focus more on Sierra instead. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's still stuff to say about iOS 10. You know, everybody's going to see it differently,
oh, sure,
even if one is very comprehensive. And I think I like to take an approach in general of just sort of, you know, there's one thing to review it. It's another thing to say, like, here's how this, you know, here's the things you can do now that will help you in your everyday life. I mean, that's kind of what I always, the angle I always took was, like, I don't necessarily want to get, like, super high level and more just want to be like, hey, you use technology. Use it, like, every day, probably. Here's how you can have it work for you better. I tend to think that that ends up being more interesting.
Yeah. Here's how to have it work for you better. That's not a good slogan, though.
It's not.
It's a lot of words.
It looks great on a t-shirt.
But nobody else is wearing.
That no one else will ever wear. This is true. I don't know. There was some stuff going on. I just noticed as we started recording this that Twitter has rolled out some new features.
Yeah, rather than get more people verified who wanted... A lot of people want to be verified on Twitter because they get access to these other features that help manage your conversation better. And it's got like a quality filter where it will just not show you tweets that it thinks are bad. And then there's actually a display option to only see tweets from people you follow and stuff like that.
So here's my question for you. You, like me, have had that blue check mark for a little while.
Yeah.
Have you ever used these features?
I have them turned on, but I think they only actually show on the web. I don't think they show in even the official Twitter client for Mac that I use.
I think, good point. So it looks like they will appear in the Twitter client on iOS, but neither of us use that.
Right.
I honestly don't even know where... I don't even know where this setting is. I don't think, and I've used Tweetbot, so
yeah, but the idea is that they brought that to everybody now, so it's good. It was always frustrating that that was a feature that that verified people got and nobody else got.
But if it doesn't pass through to the third-party clients, then that may be underwhelming for some people, or they have to go and switch what they're using. I mean, it's great that that's an option now. I hope it helps out some people who really need it. And in general, I hope that improves things. But it also seems like it may not be as impactful as we might hope. But,
right.
You know, Twitter is trying to dig itself out of a pretty deep hole when it comes to that kind of stuff these days. So
they are. Well, I mean, that's one of the frustrations about this whole thing. And I saw a lot of people talking about how, like, they were really good at deleting tweets that showed video of the Olympics, but they're not good at actually like preventing horrible like dog pile harassment stuff. And I keep thinking back to there. Several people have written about like algorithmic ways, fairly simple algorithmic ways that you could stop a lot of abuse on Twitter, having to do with being able to like see, you know, do they follow other people that you've blocked? And, you know, are there words that these people use? Do they actually follow you? How new is the account? Mm-hmm. There are so many ways that you can get signal about bad actors on Twitter. And obviously the quality filter is doing some of that. But, you know, they could do this, but it's never been a priority for them. So at least here they've eliminated, like, we built these features, but only special people get them. It's like, no, okay, everybody
gets
them.
Right, right.
That's good.
Right. Yeah, it levels the playing field.
It's something. It's a start. It's, yeah, but this is not their best area. Hey, I wrote something last week about the iPhone camera. I don't know if you saw that.
I did see this.
One of the Mark Gurman rumors is that the iPhone 6 Plus will have a two-camera system so that it will take appreciably better pictures than the smaller version.
Good, right? That's how that works?
Sure. You just get two pictures that are exactly the same quality.
I already get that with the HDR live photos. I feel like I get four pictures of every picture I take.
Well, get ready for eight.
Woohoo!
But I mean, it struck me that in some ways this is the frontier of smartphone development, that so many things about smartphones are so good that they can only be incrementally improved. And yeah, there are always improvements that can happen on software and on hardware, but the camera, and part of it is the physics of it, but the camera is one of those things where I feel like they could make huge strides there, and that would be a priority for a lot of people, including me. Like, if somebody said, if you switch to this phone, you will have the equivalent of like a 35 millimeter camera. The pictures will just be so much better, and you can zoom and not see, you know, bad digital zoom artifacts and things like that. That would be something to get me excited about a new phone.
Yeah, well, and the camera traditionally has been one place that they have iterated pretty much every year. Between the camera and the processor, it seems like for most of the iPhone's life, those are the places where things keep marching along.
Go back and look at the quality of an iPhone camera.
Yeah.
From the early days. Whew.
It's pretty bad. Yeah, I notice when I scroll through my photo library sometimes. But, you know, there's still a lot of room to grow there because those pictures can always get better. Or at least it certainly seems like that, right? Like there is just, you know, there's the upper limit on that is still pretty far away. Even just trying to match, as you said, like a 35 millimeter camera is a pretty tall order. Easy place to focus their attentions, whether, no pun intended, whether or not that is a, you know, a place where they can make appreciable gains. It's clearly a place where they put a lot of attention. And it's easier to do something like that, I think, than it is to try and come up with like a new, wow, whiz-bang feature every single iteration, which is pretty hard.
Yeah.
So I'm not surprised at all by that rumor. I think that we will see a much better camera. And as you said, with the physics of it and the space, it seems like the whatever 7 Plus or whatever that's going to be is a much easier, you know, test bed to work with, you know, more advanced cameras because there's just more space. So you can do things there that you can't necessarily do as easily in a more space-constrained environment. Although, you know, in the same way, you know, we've talked in the past about how the smaller phone, the older phones, which are smaller, but which are also thicker, also give you some ability to play around with more space, right?
Yeah.
Like there's more depth in an iPhone SE than there is in a 6 or a 6 Plus. So therefore, you have a little more room to work with. You don't end up with the unsightly camera bulges that we've been dealing with now for a couple of years.
Yeah, putting multiple images together with software is a thing that, you know, we've seen now, like doing interesting image things. Adobe, I know, you know, showed us a demo of that like 10 years ago. They had a wild demo about like using software and multiple lenses to create kind of much higher quality pictures. And I do wonder sometimes there are cameras out there that try stuff like this, clever things you can do with mirrors and things. Like, could they create a, you know, could they turn the light stream perpendicular? It just takes up space inside the phone, but could you do something that would, because you know, in the end you're capturing light, and that's a constraint. And the way the focusing works, you know, having some more depth is important. And there's physics. I mean, in the end, this is not all about just like having a faster processor. It's the physics of optics. So
right.
There's lots of different ways to do it, but it's totally changed people's lives to have cameras on them all the time. And the most, you know, the more they can do to make those better, the better, I think, is the bottom line.
And it's interesting, too, because that's not the only place where we're running up against physics and science as the limiting factor in some of the, you know, increasing the quality of some of these things. I was noting this week, or I guess 2 weeks ago when I was at Gen Con wandering around, that the external battery pack has become ubiquitous.
Yeah.
And part of that, I think, especially of late, can be blamed a little bit on Pokemon Go, which was also ubiquitous and drains a lot of battery. And part of that is we've always seen that things like conventions and shows where people are going to be using their phones constantly for a really long time. But, you know, batteries are another place where we've been running up against limits in chemistry and physics in terms of getting more capacity out of that. And if you look at the lithium ion technologies we're using right now, they're not wildly dissimilar from the lithium ion technologies we were using 20 years ago. They've definitely made advancements, and certainly they're trying to pack a lot more battery in there. But, you know, we haven't had a power revolution, you know, something along the lines of what I'm thinking of, like a change that we had when we went from like wired internet to wireless internet, right? Like that was a huge deal. That changed everything.
Yeah.
We haven't had a similar change in battery technology really in quite a long time, if ever, in this particular field. I mean, you know, you take apart an iPod from 2001 and it's, you know, your battery setup in there is pretty similar to what you've got in an iPhone today with some refinements. And so I imagine there are some, I did read an interesting article this morning, actually, talking about a company coming out of MIT that is starting commercial production of a revamped, I think it's a lithium metal battery instead, which can hold something like twice the capacity in the same space, or therefore the same capacity in half the space as existing batteries. So I'm very curious to see how these things start to pan out. Because I think, you know, battery life and power is going to become even more important, right?
Yeah.
Like we've all seen the joke on the Maslow's hierarchy of needs, where, you know, first they had Wi-Fi at the bottom of like the most, you know, below even like air and shelter and water. And now there's like battery life is at the bottom of that, right? So, you know, as we use more and more of these devices and we're using them more frequently, having a device that can go all day or 2 days is pretty critical. And, you know, we saw the same thing. You know, calculus done when, as Apple said, when they were working on the Apple Watch, in terms of prioritizing battery life being why they held back on so
right.
much of the performance on the features.
That was number one.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, this is an interesting area right now where, because the battery development seemed to be coming rather slowly, power management software has become a big thing. But, you know, my iPhone maybe can last all day, but if I'm using it all day, no way, right? It's going to die. So, you know, you need these, and no one really wants to carry around these clunky extra batteries that they have to connect to with a cable, right? Like they're bulky, they're heavy, they're just unsightly, and you got to worry about charging them up then. Like it's an inconvenient solution. And to me, seeing so many people carrying it around makes me think that is an area that people should be, you know, that the technology companies should be focusing on. And it's certainly a hard problem to solve, but it's clearly an issue.
Well, we get so focused on big picture, on software and on big picture hardware, that I think one of the areas where, because you get focused on the hardware, you're thinking about the widget that comes from the company that you buy the widget from. And maybe you go one level down and say, okay, yeah, but they're using this processor. But you go far enough down, and so much of what we use today in terms of this technology stuff is on the cutting edge in terms of pushing against the laws of physics. And, you know, they've been saying for ages now, well, Moore's law is not gonna last because of the laws of physics. And that's sort of starting to happen. But I on one side, I think to myself, at some point, as with anything, we will have wrung most of the efficiency out of these things. And then we're going to just sort of realize, like, the phones in 10 years or 20 years are not going to be, you know, have year-long batteries and weigh an ounce. Like, at some point,
right, sure.
Ergonomics aside of having to hold them, at some point, it will slow. Because there's no way you're going to be able to have an infinite battery on a device that uses, you know, whatever power it needs. It's not going to happen. But on the other hand, we are constantly surprised at the cleverness of people whose job it is to come up with new ways to make a better battery, to make increasingly smaller chips.
Right.
Like if you showed a modern chip to a chip engineer from 15 years ago, I think they would pass out. Like, and that just because, well, it's like, how could you get it that small?
Do you think so? I mean, like, it seems like, I feel like those people are very used to the idea, like they can sort of project out from where they are.
Yeah, but I think if you're deep down in the nitty gritty, because I remember Intel talking about smaller processes, and obviously Moore's law is what Intel is all about.
Right.
But, you know, there was always thought about, like, well, we can't get below this point. And then there was but we're going to do lithography, where if people don't know about that. I mean, the idea that you would take a picture of what you wanted the circuit diagram to be, and the picture would be laid down with the picture would be the circuit. Would be the circuitry, like the picture that was transformed because you were using it as a picture, but the picture was laid down with metal, then that was the chip. I mean, the techniques and the cleverness that goes into this, and now they're talking about, you know, micro scale, like nanotech level scale for this stuff, where you get down to the level of like atoms. I mean, you start to get down to like quantum fluctuations being an issue.
Right, sure.
Right? So, I mean, I don't know. I think 15 years, 20 years, I think they would be amazed, not that it happened, but just the scale of it, because there's always that thought of like, this is the level below which we can't go, and then they go below it. And at some point, yeah, unless we've got quantum computers or we burrowed into another universe or something like that, it seems like at some point you're going to run out.
Well, yeah, and I thought about this the other day, actually, because I think as I was reading this news about Intel and ARM, you know, they talked about fabricating 7-nanometer chips. I think the current process is 10 nanometers. And you think about the difference between 10 nanometers and 7 nanometers, and you're like, wow, that seems very small, but it makes a huge difference.
Yeah.
And so the question is like, yeah, where does that end? We're down to single-digit nanometers.
Then we go to 5 nanometers, then we go to 2 nanometers, then we go to 1 nanometer, then we go to...
What's below picometers?
Yeah. And then we go to negative nanometers, where we're in the pocket universe then.
Ah, good. That's worth expanding in.
Yeah, it's... Well, I mean... Yeah, it's like approaching the speed of light. You never actually get there. You just get a little bit. You get a little bit closer
until you break the entire universe.
Or I mean, what happens with a lot of these things is that they then have a different way of thinking about it. I mean, we have today's computers are more powerful in some ways because in the 90s and 2000s, Intel and the other chip manufacturers realized that one way they were going to keep on getting speed boosts in computers was by putting multiple processor cores and having software that split the work up. And to this day, I mean, if you talk about going back in time, if you told me of 15 years ago how little software is properly multi-threaded, even now I would have been very sad, because like the fact is that, yeah, there's a lot of software. I see it because I have iStat menus running. I see it, like, some of my audio filters that I use to take noise out totally fill up all the cores, and others just don't. They're chugging away, and it says, this will be 2 minutes, and I look, and it's using one core, and it's infuriating. But anyway, the point is that they realize that we can't just keep going down this path. We also need to be thinking about like other methods of making this happen. And that's where sometimes the breakthroughs come. It's like, it's not the old saying about, it's not building a faster horse, it's building building the car.
And now we're worried about building a faster car, which is also the wrong idea. Right?
When jetpacks are clearly the way to go.
Hover cars, yeah, whatever. Yeah, no, yeah. I agree. That those lateral moves is what's always interesting about technology developing. Is like, yeah, you can keep scaling up. It almost looks like one of those like stair step diagrams, right? Where it's like, oh, we're, you know, building this new thing. We're gonna make it faster and faster. Oh, we're going over here. Nope, we're gonna make this faster and faster. Nope, we're going over here. Right?
Like, I read a story about and it was people trying to get Britain to back out of its, I think it was Britain, back out of this agreement that it had made to build nuclear power plants. And part of the reason is that in the last like 3 years since this agreement was started, and forgive me, I'm not getting the details, I'm hazy about the details here, but the nut of it is they made assumptions about what the cost of solar power would be that already are wrong by so much that, I mean, literally it's people saying you have to stop this because we don't need it. Like, it's a bad deal. You're buying power at this level of kilowatts per hour that is actually it's going to be way overpriced. It's already going to be way overpriced. And that's one of those cases where solar technology has outstripped almost any projection for how cheap it would be. And it's one of those things that I follow, you know, Ramez Nam, the writer.
I saw his mention about this earlier. We're talking about, it was South America where they were saying it's so much cheaper than.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. The Chile now has.
Yeah,
Chile
everything.
Has changed
coal,
their.
Oil, gas, everything.
Yeah. It was always the thought about solar as well. Solar will get cheaper and wind will get cheaper and hydro will get cheaper. But, you know, you're still going to need. And now it sounds like, you know, it's becoming very clear that that's not true.
Well, there's a number of things attacking that, right? Like, you know, it's gotten cheaper to make the thing, you know, make the apparatus required.
Yep.
it's, you know, people have on the other end, like people have been working on making electronics and things that are more efficient.
Yep.
Because that's just a concern in everyday use.
That's how
right?
you solve so you, the iPhone battery problem too. Right. Is it's not just a bigger battery; it's less
power management.
Yeah, it's exactly.
Yeah,
right.
And so we're used to we're using that in more and more places because we want to stop using so much energy. Period. That it you know depresses the cost of the energy itself too. But it is. I mean, I was thinking we have this the story that's been going around in New England up here is that they're getting ready to open the first offshore wind farm in the U.S. Off Block Island in Rhode Island. And that, you know, took a long time to get going. And they, in fact, they were talking about how all the people working on the project are pretty much like European because that's where all the expertise is.
Oh, yeah.
Like the project leader is Dutch, apparently, because like I think the Dutch have like a huge amount of offshore wind stuff.
Yeah, and I've seen a lot of it in when I was in Denmark. I saw they,
yeah,
they have.
Yeah, they talk about the Danes
mind
too,
blowing
yeah.
amount in the Baltic Sea. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. And it's, so, yeah. And that also helps your mix too because, yeah, another piece from Ramez. People should follow him, Ramez on Twitter. He's great, and he writes science fiction novels. He writes about future of energy, lots of cool stuff. He's a very smart guy. This all changes. And it changes your notion of like there are three power grids in the U.S. And you know one of the things that he wrote was you need to connect those grids. We need a better way to interconnect the grids because one of the things about solar is obviously it's only during the day. And if you have a cloudy day too, you're going to get less solar. And people are like, well, we still need this infrastructure of other sources of power generation for when it's nighttime. But that may not actually be true because a lot of the wind stuff generates at night. And if you have enough of all of it and it's all interconnected, then you can get to a fairly smooth level without needing a plant that is, you know, coal fired or nuclear or even gas fired.
Well, presumably, yeah. Depending on your volumes too, you might be able to store some of that.
Well, and storage is another thing. I actually read a great story a few months ago about this project. It's like a pilot project out in the desert, and it's like a big 2-ton slab or something, and it's on a hillside. And now it sounds so wacky, and yet it's really brilliant because, you know, as a kid, you learn in school about like kinetic energy and potential energy. Mm-hmm. So the idea is you're out there and there's a hillside next to a solar farm, and it doesn't have to be next to it, but let's say it is. And the sun is shining and the solar farm is putting out so much energy that it's more energy than anybody in California needs. So what they do is they power an electric motor that pushes the stone,
slab
up the hill.
And then it just rolls down again.
And then...
And generates kinetic energy in the way back.
And then when it's dark, they let it loose, and it pushes down the hill, right. And that generates power.
It's like when you break in your Prius.
And it's a physical battery, right? Instead of a chemical battery like we have so much of, it's a physical battery, where you use the excess energy to store it by pushing the slab up the hill. And I have no idea whether that will ever be practical or not, or whether we'll rely on things like what Elon Musk wants to do, which is put, you know, have every house with solar panels on it have a big battery system in it. Mm-hmm. So that you're not giving into the grid in the daytime and pulling at night, but you're just sort of never pulling from the grid if you don't have to. But I thought it was a really, again, outside the box kind of idea of like, yeah, why don't we just, yeah, we'll just use some electric motors to store that, to use our excess electricity to store it as potential energy in this big, you know, brick, big block.
Well, cool, you got, the cool only idea. Problem there is you got to watch out for when it rolls down the hill into your solar array. That's a problem.
Yeah, well, you needed some padding at the bottom. I think it would, need to be a controlled descent, but it's a cool idea anyway, because it's all energy, right?
You know who would have been all about that? Sisyphus.
Oh yeah, no. That, I think that would you would totally have to call it Project Sisyphus, right?
I feel like that's bad branding.
Yeah, I guess. I mean,
it's a little too on point. Let's put it that way.
Feed your dog Prometheus brand liver. Yeah, right. It was Prometheus who got his liver pecked out eternally.
Yeah, good for him. He's doing okay.
Yeah, no, he's not. It's very bad. Anyway, there's some mythology for you all. We'll have to work up the August edition of the Six Colors magazine. I'm going to have to get that going now that back.
That's the thing we need to do.
It is a thing, because months happen. Months, how do they work?
I really don't know.
I don't know either. But
that gives me a great idea for a story in the magazine.
Yeah.
Calendars.
Calendars.
How do they work?
It is a good question. I actually looked on my... iPad the other day. Yesterday, I was trying to see what was going on Saturday, and there was apparently a bug in the calendar. It literally, I was in week view where it shows you 7 days, mm-hmm. and it said Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Sunday, Monday. What? Saturday was gone. Saturday go?
That is the new regime. There is no more Saturday.
Thanks. Sorry.
Your weekend is one day now.
That's the worst. All right. Well, thanks to everybody out there for listening, including the people who came to the Memphis meetup. For listening to this and subscribing to Six Colors, we really appreciate it. Even when we're on vacation, we appreciate it because then we
especially
come back.
We especially appreciate that because we can go on vacation.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. And it's good to be back. We didn't talk last week, so hey, here we are. We're back. Remember us? We're back.
We're back.
And now we're gonna go away, but we'll talk to each other and you next week.
We'll be back.
Yeah, exactly. All right. See you later, Dan. Bye.
Bye, Jason.